For the talks this week, we would like to have the theme of the Four Noble Truths. So tonight, this afternoon, I'll give an overview of the Four Noble Truths, and then we'll go into more detail as we go through the week. When the Buddha had his realization, when he woke up and discovered the truth for himself of the end of suffering, he didn't originally think that anybody would understand what he had learned. He said to himself that this Dharma that he uncovered, that he had seen, is so subtle that he did not think that people would be able to see it. But then he thought about five companions that he had been spending time with during his time of ascetic practices, and he thought, maybe they will understand. And so he went and sought them out and looked for them so that he could communicate what he had come to understand. And what he decided to communicate to them, what he decided to say, the first thing he thought of in terms of an expression of his understanding was a teaching on the Four Noble Truths. Now we normally think of, as we have come to understand the Four Noble Truths, in some ways they seem very simple. They don't seem like something that somebody would think, nobody's going to understand this. But the truth, the depth of the truth of what the Four Noble Truths point to is very subtle, very profound, and very hard to see. But we can begin to understand a little bit at a time. We can start to understand what he's talking about, what these truths are pointing to. And layer by layer, as we meet and understand even a little bit, it pulls us deeper. It pulls us into more and more understanding. So to me, it seems as though this teaching of the Four Noble Truths, where we begin with just an intellectual understanding, and as we engage, that intellectual understanding reveals more and more of the truth in our experience, the truth of these truths in our experience. There's one description of the Dharma that it is said that the Dharma is onward leading. And my understanding of that is that a little bit of an understanding, a little bit of a flavor of the Dharma, when put into practice, begins to pull us deeper and deeper. That it's as if we have locked our minds or our experience onto a kind of a radar that points us towards freedom. So the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. When the Buddha talked to his five companions about these four truths, he didn't just simply say these as, well, these are truths. He stated them as with each truth, there was an action he associated with it, something to do. The noble truth of suffering is to be understood. The noble truth of the cause of suffering is meant to be abandoned or let go of. The noble truth of the cessation of suffering is meant to be realized. And the noble truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering is meant to be cultivated or developed. So this points to me to the pragmatic aspect of the Buddhist teaching. That these truths are more meant to be engaged with than simply believed as some kind of a metaphysical statement of reality. And this really set the Buddha apart from the teachers of his time. That the many of the religious orders were about trying to uncover some kind of metaphysical truth, and that understanding that truth would lead to freedom. And the Buddha pointed to acting on these truths, to understand suffering, to let go of its cause, to realize the release from suffering by cultivating the path. So the truth of suffering, the term usually translated as suffering, as most of you, I think, know, is dukkha. And this term, while it is usually translated as suffering, most people who translate it also indicate that it conveys a very broad understanding of suffering. Other terms such as dissatisfaction, unease, distress, or stress convey a little bit more of the breadth of this term, dukkha. Being in a human body, having a human mind, being in a physical body, having a mind, we are subject to physical and mental pleasure and pain. With respect to the physical aspect of our experience, what we experience in the body as pain is not really what the Buddha was talking about as being what dukkha is. He really clearly said and stated that even an enlightened person will experience physical pain and physical pleasantness, physical unpleasantness and physical pleasantness. He said the distinction between an ordinary person who experiences physical unpleasantness and the enlightened person or fully awakened person who feels physical unpleasantness is that an ordinary person, when they feel physical unpleasantness, they beat their breasts, they moan, they wail, they suffer, they lament, they grieve. Why me? Whereas, he said, a person who has understood dukkha, has understood that when they experience physical unpleasantness, they experience physical unpleasantness. It stops there. So essentially, the dukkha that the Buddha was pointing to has to do with our mental responses to our experience, our mental reactivity. So in our ordinariness of us experiencing physical pain, we typically have some kind of a reaction to it. We don't like it, we want to fix it, we want to control it, we want to get rid of it. And not only do we react to our physical unpleasant experience, we then in turn also react to any mental unpleasantness. So there's this whole chain of reactivity that gets set up. So mental distress covers a range of experience. This dukkha covers a range of experience. I'll give you a few words. This is by no means comprehensive. Disturbance, worry, fear, anguish, dread, desire, longing, frustration, insufficiency, loss, vacillation, uncertainty, aversion. Our reactions, our mental reactions, this dukkha, this suffering, might not be strong. It might not be a strong unhappiness or a strong kind of suffering, but there might be some feeling that we have of, is there something more to life? Or it might be, what's wrong with me? Or why don't things work out? We have almost always a little bit of dissonance with the way things are. Either we like things as they are and we want them to stay the way they are, which is an exercise in frustration because things don't stay the way they are. Or we don't like the way things are, and we want to try to fix them and change them and control them. So we don't always see. So an interesting phenomenon about this dukkha is that we don't always see what is suffering, what is dukkha, as dukkha. We don't always recognize it as dukkha. It can be masked by our own minds. It can be masked. So, for example, for states of disliking or of aversion, when we are in a space of not liking something, the kind of suffering of that space of aversion can be masked because we are focused on what the world would be like or what the world will be like when we manage to fix this thing. So we essentially have in our minds an idea of the world without this thing that we don't like. And we are living in that idea. And that idea is pleasant. That idea is appealing. And so the actuality of the kind of dissatisfying nature of not liking things as they are is hidden from us because we are projecting into the future in this fantasy or this idea some pleasant sense of how things might be when I manage to control, manipulate, fix, change, get rid of this thing. So when we're in this state of not liking, we're often focused on something in the world. We're focused out there rather than on this experience of the not liking itself. And when we're focused out there, there might be in our experience, if we can manage to fix, to control, to change, there's a sense of real pleasantness around that ability. I can do this. There's a real sense of, yes, this, I'm in control. I've got things under control. That feeling of being the one who has things under control feels good. Again, masking that sense of unpleasant, sense of the suffering of the aversion. Or we might be, if we're in a space of aversion around a particular person, a real strong feeling of anger or hostility towards someone else, we might miss our own suffering in that because we're more focused on how that other person might be feeling. I had a kind of a realization around this in my own experience pretty early in my practice. One of the first things I was observing in my practice was this experience of anger at a particular person. And at some point, aided by the fact that the person I was angry with was 7,000 miles away, I began to recognize in my heart this belief or this assumption that my anger would somehow hurt him. That was kind of a motivating force behind the anger, that I wanted him to suffer. And it was pretty clear, being 7,000 miles away, that he was not experiencing anything when I was angry, but I was really clearly seeing myself how much it was hurting me. That was quite a revelation, actually. It was like, it sounds silly in a way, or obvious, but it was a real eye-opener that this, I uncovered this belief that the anger would hurt him when it was actually hurting me. So I directly saw into that truth of suffering. In states of wanting, this dukkha can be masked. The states of wanting things to stay the way they are, the dukkha is masked partly because in the getting what we want, in the movement towards getting what we want and having it, there's the happiness of having it. And there's not the deeper recognition in the impermanent nature of this thing that we now have. We somehow believe that we figured it out and that because we have this thing, we are really going to be happy. Now, we wouldn't, you know, really say, yes, I believe that having this piece of chocolate is going to make me happy for the rest of my life. But we do, in a way, believe that happiness consists in stringing together moments like that. And so, we're focused on the world. We're focused on the happiness of the moment, and not seeing the inherent unsatisfactoriness of that thing that we're holding on to. Because it will go away. And what we will be left with then is a wanting to have that feeling back again. And so the wanting itself becomes this chain, this cycle. Once we start to see suffering for what it is, once we start to really meet and recognize, as I did with that experience, oh, this is hurting me. Once we start to see that, we can begin to recognize that it's valuable to understand it. That rather than trying to get rid of the suffering or push it away, we start to understand that the way out or the way is through it rather than trying to manipulate it. So this understanding, this is the action that the Buddha suggested for us around the First Noble Truth. Understand suffering. Now this understanding that the Buddha talked about was not an intellectual understanding. It's a turning towards the experience, a direct meeting of the experience with mindfulness. Observing, what is this suffering? What is this experience? That's a radical shift for us. Normally we don't, in our normal life, we would hardly think that the way to work with suffering would be to turn towards it, to understand it. We think that we're supposed to manipulate it, fix it. We've been trained to manipulate, to fix, control, that's the way to happiness. But instead, the Buddha suggests that we should be kind of like a scientist or a botanist observing nature. Start to look at, get interested in understanding how our suffering comes to be. A kind of a data gathering around this suffering, not in order to fix or manipulate, but to understand. One of my teachers, Sayadaw Utejaniya, gives a beautiful analogy around this process of understanding and gathering data. This is the kind of data gathering that we need to employ in looking at our suffering. He said, you know, think about the first people who looked up at the stars, the first humans that thought to look up at the stars and wonder about them. And then they started observing. There weren't any books to read. There weren't any people who understood them already. So what they did was just observe. Just notice the patterns. And in observing, night after night after night, after month after year, after year after year, patterns begin to emerge. This is the way it works for us in understanding suffering. Time after time, we turn towards our suffering. We see it and we learn how our suffering comes to be. Not by trying to figure it out, but by meeting it and just witnessing it. Those first humans looking up at the stars began to understand the patterns of the stars and the patterns of the planets through the observation, just the meeting of experience. The same thing with meeting our experience of suffering. The patterns become clear just by the observation, just looking at what is obvious. So as we make this exploration, we get to know the experience of suffering. We get to realize, we recognize suffering as suffering. We start to see how our own minds contribute to this process of suffering, and we begin to understand something of the causes of suffering. Second Noble Truth, the truth of the cause of suffering. So the second noble truth, I think it's interesting and important to highlight and point out that the second noble truth says that suffering has a cause. It's not a random event in our lives. Suffering is created by causes and conditions. This is actually good news, because since it's created by causes and conditions, we can learn about those causes and conditions, and by learning about those causes and conditions, we begin to see how the structure of our lives can change such that those conditions and causes change. So the cause of suffering is craving. wanting. This is what the Buddha pointed to, that we want things to be other than they are. Either we don't like something and we want things to be different than they are right now, or we like things as they are and we don't want them to change. So there's this continual resistance, a dissatisfaction with things as they are. So the craving, the wanting that causes suffering has a sense of neediness, of stickiness to it. The term in Pali that the Buddha used for this, tanha, literally means thirst. And this, I think, gives a sense of the kind of feeling of real urgency or craving or stickiness to the quality of craving that leads us to suffering. Because when we are thirsty, it's like a biological need to get water. So we'll just go anywhere to get the water when we are really thirsty. So the craving has this sense of being driven or a sense of impelled or controlled by the thing that we want. So not all desire, not all wanting is unskillful. A sense of form of desire actually helps us along the way in this path. I'll offer you the term aspiration for that. That term to me conveys a sense of a movement in a direction without that sense of neediness to have a certain result. So this craving, this wanting that causes suffering includes both the desire to have things and the desire to get rid of things. Both movements, the movement of wanting to have something and wanting to get rid of something, are included in this notion of craving. So there's a connection in this to a very basic experience that we have of things being pleasant, unpleasant in our experience. And when things are pleasant, we like them, we want more of them. When things are unpleasant, we don't like them, we want to get rid of them, we push them away. So when we start to observe our experience, turning to our experience with mindfulness, we really begin to see how pervasive these patterns are. Of moving from, oh, there's something pleasant. Oh, I like that. I want it. Oh, I've got to have it. Or, oh, I don't like that. Got to get rid of it. Oh, it's going to drive me nuts. So one of the things, I think it was a brilliant thing that the Buddha uncovered, that this wanting itself is the source of our suffering. As we observe this wanting, we really see that it inherent with it, when we turn towards the feeling of wanting itself, instead of being focused on the thing that we want. We're focused on the thing that we want. We may be in the realm again of a fantasy of, oh, what's life going to be like when I have this thing? And so we're, again, not meeting experience as it is, not turning directly to face the feeling of wanting. When we turn to face that feeling, it's a fundamental feeling of something's off. You know, things are not satisfied. There's a feeling of not being satisfied. And if we start to look at this feeling of not being satisfied, we see that when that feeling of not being satisfied goes away, the dissatisfaction goes away. So when the wanting goes away, the suffering goes away. So this leads to the action the Buddha suggested we take with craving. Abandon craving, let go of craving. So this letting go, this abandoning, it can have an active quality to it where we sense that when we see the wanting, we see, you know, this isn't so helpful. And there's an active sense of, I don't need to do that anymore. But I would say more often, at least in my experience, more often what happens around this wanting is that we see that we can't stop the wanting by wanting to stop it. So there is a way that we, again, turning towards the feeling of wanting itself, rather than acting on the feeling of wanting, turning towards that feeling of wanting, there's a sense of letting be, letting the wanting be, observing the wanting, not acting on it, turning mindful attention to this feeling. And because we are not acting on the feeling of wanting, wanting is an impermanent phenomenon. It will disappear on its own if we're not feeding it and revving it up. So if we can turn our mindful attention to the wanting without acting on it, we'll see that it basically lets go of itself. Essentially through the nature of all things being impermanent. And we start to see the ending of the wanting is the ending of the suffering. The third noble truth is the truth of the ending of suffering. So this is actually really good news. This is possible. We can sometimes look at the Four Noble Truths as the way that they're stated as essentially being the Buddha being a doctor pointing out the illness of mankind being suffering. That when you go to a doctor and they identify the problem, it's the first thing you do when you go to a doctor. Okay, what's wrong? Well, the problem is suffering. What's the cause? The cause is the wanting. Is it possible to be free of this? Yes, it's possible. This is the good news. The disease is curable. And there's a prescription, which I'll get to in a moment. So it is possible to realize the end of suffering. By understanding the suffering, by letting go of its cause or letting be, the suffering will come to an end. This third noble truth, the ending of suffering, a term often used for this is Nibbana or Nirvana. Nibbana being the Pali term, Nirvana being the Sanskrit term. And primarily it's described in the Buddhist texts through negative descriptions. It's described as the ending of suffering, as the absence of greed, aversion, and delusion, as the cessation of craving. It's defined essentially by what it's not, rather than being a statement of something that it is. I'm going to read you some of the descriptions from the suttas about Nibbana. What I'm going to read here is from four different passages, different texts, but they kind of flow together, so I'm just going to read them all as one. The extinction of greed, the extinction of hate, the extinction of delusion. This indeed is called Nibbana. If lust, anger, and delusion are given up, man aims neither at his own ruin, nor at the ruin of others, nor at the ruin of both, and he experiences no mental pain and grief. This is Nibbana, immediate, visible in this life, inviting, attractive, and comprehensible to the wise. And for a disciple thus freed, in whose heart dwells peace, there is nothing to be added to what has been done, and naught more remains for her to do. Just as a rock of one solid mass remains unshaken by the wind, even so, neither forms, nor sounds, nor odors, nor tastes, nor contacts of any kind, neither the desired nor the undesired, can cause such a one to waver. Steadfast is her mind, gained is deliverance. This is peace, this is exquisite, the resolution of all fabrications, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, dispassion, cessation, Nibbana. In those passages, I particularly like one aspect where it says, if lust, anger, and delusion are given up, one experiences no mental pain and grief. Imagine what that would be like. No mental pain and grief. And he goes on to say, this is immediate, visible in this life. This is not something that is, it's not a path leading to some distant resolution in the future, sometime after we die. He points to it as being a path that leads to this release, no mental pain and grief, immediate, visible in this life. This is possible. The Buddha says it's possible. I have very strong confidence in this possibility. So, non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. One of my teachers, Joseph Goldstein, points to or says that he thinks that moments of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion actually happen to us all the time. But we just don't notice them. That it's actually a pretty subtle experience when there is no greed, no aversion, and no delusion. And our minds are habituated to much more obvious phenomena. So these moments of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion may flit by without our recognizing them. One teacher, Ajahn Buddhadasa, a great teacher from the last century in Thailand, called these moments that Joseph is talking about temporary Nibbana. And he says of this, anyone can see, this is paraphrased, anyone can see if states of greed, aversion, and delusion were with us all day and night, every second without ceasing, living things must either die or become insane. Let us consider that we survive because there are periods that the fires of greed, aversion, and delusion are not burning. So Ajahn Buddhadasa and Joseph say that these moments happen and actually provide a kind of a nourishment that keep us going. But we don't recognize them. They keep us going, but we don't have any clue that they're happening. This points to the action that the Buddha said needs to happen around this third noble truth. It needs to be realized. So we can begin by learning to recognize small shifts in our experience as we turn our attention to our experience, bringing mindfulness to our suffering. As we turn our attention, stop resisting the suffering, stop trying to fix, to change, stop trying to have control, manipulate so that everything is organized in my world the way I want it to be, we may find that in this just turning towards, there's a space, some opening, a sense of, it's not a problem that this is happening. A little bit of a release around the suffering itself. Recognize that shift. It's a pointer. It's a pointer towards this ending of greed, aversion, and delusion. That's the direction. Or, as you observe wanting, as you turn your attention towards the feeling of wanting, instead of acting on wanting, just observing, watching the feeling of wanting, you may see the moment the wanting vanishes. If you see that moment, you will really directly understand how the wanting itself is so directly connected to the suffering. It feels like being released from a vice grip when that wanting disappears. So learning to recognize these small moments begins to point us in the direction of this realization. So the Buddha recognized that there are some specific things that we can do to address this problem of suffering. We don't have to grope around blindly or stumble around hoping that we'll somehow just magically or, you know, accidentally stumble into something that will lead us out of suffering. If we try it that direction, we're not likely to stumble into it. He said there's actually a path that we can follow, the Noble Eightfold Path. Wise understanding, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. This is the fourth noble truth, the truth of the path leading to the end of suffering. So it starts, the first two aspects, wise understanding and wise intention. It starts with this, with essentially a little bit of an understanding of suffering, how it's caused and what the actions are that might alleviate that suffering. Initially, the understanding that we work with as we engage in the practice of the Eightfold Path, initially this understanding is intellectual. We hear some teachings. We hear the teachings, in fact, of the Four Noble Truths, perhaps. And perhaps it inspires us to take some action. We might see people who inspire us, hear teachings that inspire us, that may give us some confidence that there's a different way to live our lives. So with that little bit of wisdom and the confidence that comes with it, even though it's an intellectual understanding, the confidence that comes with it can impel us to take some action, to take some steps on the path, to engage with some practices. The first set of practices that are suggested in the Eightfold Path are ethical practices. This is the aspect of wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood. And this is really, the ethical practice is really about harmonizing our relationship with the world. It points to the fact that our spiritual practice isn't simply about sitting down and closing our eyes and doing an inward gazing. It's about engagement and engaging in skillful ways, getting our relationships with the world, with ourselves, with others, into a place of harmony, a place of peacefulness, a place of non-harming. So with the understanding that we have that inspires us, a little bit of an understanding about suffering that inspires us to engage, we also begin to see that the suffering that we are working with is more universal. So it's not just ourselves. And that brings out some compassion, which inspires us more towards this practice of harmony, of non-harming. The next set of practices that are suggested in the Eightfold Path are related to mental cultivation, cultivating our minds. So why do we need to cultivate our minds on this path? What is the point? What is the purpose of cultivating our minds? Well, it goes back to, we need to go back to the understanding of what is stress, what is suffering about. Suffering happens because we resist things that we don't like. We want to hold on to things that we like. In trying to hold on, we suffer because things change. If we're dissatisfied with things, trying to fix them, control them, we suffer because we are pinning our hopes on arranging the world that is ultimately not arrangeable. It's arrangeable for moments of time. But as soon as it's arranged, it immediately changes or starts to change. No sooner does it get into an arrangement does it start to decay. So we're pinning our hopes on happiness to something outside of us. And these processes of wanting to hold on, to fix, to change, are processes that happen in our minds. So the resistance to things as they are is a process that happens in our own mind. The wanting things to be other than they are is a process that's happening in our own minds. So it's in our own minds that our suffering is created. And the Buddha saw this. He saw that the vast majority of what we struggle with, I think he would say all of what we struggle with, is created by our own minds. Hence the need to cultivate our minds. For mental cultivation, to look at our minds to understand how they work. And typically, our minds are pretty scattered. They jump around, trying to figure out what will make us happy, trying to arrange the world. Our minds are propelled by our habits, our patterns, a kind of a reactivity that feeds on not being aware of it. And essentially, that unawareness is a food for these patterns of reactivity. We often feel like we are at the mercy of these habits and patterns. And particularly as we start to turn our attention and pay attention to our minds, we see just how much our minds are out of control. So this mental cultivation begins to bring our minds into some amount of settledness. This, the three components of the Eightfold Path that are related to mental cultivation are wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. And these three aspects work together to help to settle our minds. So we make the effort. Wise effort is about making the effort to stay connected to what is happening in the present moment. And it's important that that effort be made with infused by some of the wisdom that the path begins with. Some of the wisdom of what is it that causes suffering? What is it that leads us away from suffering? So we make the effort to cultivate those things that lead us away from suffering and let go of those things that lead us towards suffering in our moment-to-moment experience. So this is a cultivation of wise effort and wise mindfulness together. So bringing effort and mindfulness together, we pay attention, we make the effort to bring our attention to moment-by-moment experience, moment after moment, as best we can, coming back, making that effort to bring the mindfulness. And it's this effort to come back moment after moment after moment that results in concentration. So it cultivates concentration, this sustaining of our mindfulness over time. It supports a stabilizing of the mind. It supports our ability to not be so reactive when things don't go the way we'd like them to. It helps to settle down that emotional reactivity. As this emotional reactivity settles down, we start to be able to see and meet our experience more as it is, rather than through the filter of what we like and don't like, what we think is good and bad, rather than through the filter of what we want and don't want. We begin to be able to just meet experience. And in this meeting of experience, using wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration, directly meeting experience, we start to gain a first-hand understanding about this wisdom that was previously only an intellectual understanding. We begin to know for ourselves, experientially, not intellectually. We begin to know ourselves, the truths of the Four Noble Truths. In practice, these truths are not linear. There's a cyclic nature to the Four Noble Truths inherent in it. In the Four Noble Truths, the last of the Four Noble Truths is the path, the Eightfold Path, the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And the first aspect of that path, wise understanding, is most typically described as an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. So inherently, this Four Noble Truths contains a cycle. And I think, too, that each truth, when completely, fully acted on with the action the Buddha suggested for that truth, when completely, fully acted on, all of the truths are understood. So, for example, when we turn our attention to suffering, to understand it, we use the Eightfold Path to understand it. Particularly wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. We're using those as tools to understand suffering. When suffering is fully understood by developing the Eightfold Path, in that understanding, the mind sees and understands its cause and naturally lets go of it. It's not something we have to do or to try to, it's not an action we have to take. When the mind fully understands suffering, it fully understands the cause of suffering and will naturally let go of that cause. In that letting go of that cause, the cessation of suffering is realized. So in our experience, moment to moment, we can meet our experience essentially seen through the framework of the Four Noble Truths. What is arising in our experience might be suffering. The instruction, understand it. What might be arising in our experience is the wanting, the craving, the instruction, let go, let be. What might be arising in our experience is qualities that are supporting the cultivation. Might be mindfulness, generosity, happiness, tranquility. We may be cultivating those. That may be what's happening. Cultivate those qualities. Or we might be experiencing the ending of suffering. Realize that. So moment by moment, meeting our experience. In a sense, we can use these Four Noble Truths as a frame of reference through which to understand our experience. Understand suffering, let go of its cause. Cultivate the path to realize the cessation of suffering. Let's sit for a moment. Thank you for your attention.